When it became too dark to see where they were heading, Smoke set up another camp in a small grove of trees to protect him from the worst of the wind and snow. He pulled the horses together and tied them to a tree so their bodies were against each other for added warmth, and he fed them plenty of oats to help keep their body temperatures up against the frigid air. After the men ate, he had Pearly wrap their food up in a blanket and hang it from the branch of a birch tree so it was 6 feet or so off the ground.
Why are you doing that, Smoke?
This time of year, most of the bears are trying to put on weight for their winter hibernation. They can smell food for miles, and anything they can smell, they think is theirs. Nothing worse than having a hungry bear walking up on you trying to eat your food, or even worse, trying to make you his dinner.
You think there's any chance of that happening tonight?
Always a chance up here. That's why we're going to take turns keeping that fire going strong until the morning. Bears have a natural aversion to fire. Of course, sometimes if he's hungry enough, a bear will come right into a camp, fire or no fire. So sleep with one eye open, boys.
Thanks for telling us that, Smoke. Now I probably won't get any sleep at all.
In spite of his professed fear, 2 minutes after his head hit the saddle, which he was using for a pillow, Cal was out like a light. Pearly raised his head and smirked.
Hell, if the fire don't keep them bears away, Cal snoring surely will.
Two days later, they came upon the entrance to the valley below the notch in the mountains. For the first time since they left Buffalo, the ground was level and the temperature seemed less extreme.
Why is it getting warmer, Smoke?
Look up there, Pearly. We're protected on three sides by the mountains as they rise around the valley. I suspect that's another reason the Nez Perce pick this place to winter every year.
The farther they traveled into the valley, the shallower the snowdrifts became, until there were hardly any on the ground at all. Suddenly, Cal pulled his rifle out of its boot and aimed it off to the side, cocking the hammer back.
What are you doing?
Cal pointed off toward a large buck deer, standing in the shallow snow 75 yards away, its head down as it pawed snow off tender green shoots of grass and grazed.
Well, I thought I'd shoot that buck over there and we'd have some venison for dinner tonight.
See those small piles of stones every 50 yards or so along the trail, piled up to a point?
No, hadn't noticed.
Those are Nez Perce signal rocks. They show this as their territory, and I doubt they would take kindly to us killing game on land they've claimed as their own.
But I haven't seen an Indian yet, Smoke.
Oh, they're there. They've been trailing us for the past 6 hours, keeping just out of sight on the mountainsides on either side of us.
Damn! I don't think I'll ever get the hang of this mountaineering.
Don't feel bad, Cal. I lived up here for several years with Preacher when I was about your age, and a day didn't go by that he didn't teach me something new about being a mountain man. There's a hell of a lot to learn, and if you don't have a good teacher, the mountain will jump up and kill you before you have a chance to learn it all.
Seems like the more Cal and I learn, the more we don't know about life up here.
Smoke got down off his horse and undid one of the ties to the pack horse. He pulled a bag of Arbuckle's coffee out of the pack, along with the coffee pot.
Help me make a fire, boys. I think it's time we introduced ourselves before we get any closer to the Nez Perce camp. It ain't polite to go calling until we've been invited.
After they had the fire going and a large pot of coffee brewing, Smoke instructed Cal and Pearly to sit next to the fire, hands in plain sight and away from their weapons. As they sat drinking the coffee, he set several more cups around the fire, off to the side, by themselves.
That's just to let them know they're expected and welcome.
Within 15 minutes, two braves who appeared to be in their early 20s, accompanied by a younger brave about 12 years old, walked their ponies into Smoke's camp. Without getting up, Smoke waved them toward the campfire.
Coffee's brewing, and you're welcome to join us.
You think they speak English?
Most of the younger braves do by now. There's been so many trappers up here, they've managed to learn enough to get by. If they don't, we'll have to use sign language. But I'm a mite rusty, so I hope these men know our lingo.
As the braves dismounted, Smoke noticed one was carrying an old muzzle-loaded rifle, while the other two had bows and arrows, and one of them had a stone tomahawk stuck in his breeches within easy reach.
Most of the Indians I've met have a real taste for coffee. They don't get to partake in it very often.
The eldest of the three walked up to stand next to the fire and stared down at Smoke. He patted his chest with an open palm.
I am called Spotted Elk.
And I am known as Man Who Walks on Mountain.
The brave's eyes widened, and he grinned.
Would you care for some coffee?
Cafecito?
They gathered close to the fire, and Smoke poured them full cups.
Burly, get the bag of sugar out of the pack. Indians have a real hankering for sugar with their coffee.
When the young brave tasted his coffee and made a face at its bitterness, Smoke reached over and poured a generous helping of sugar into the strong black brew. The brave took another tentative sip, then he broke into a wide grin, and he drank down the entire cup in one long swallow.
Running Deer's first time with the black water called Cafecito.
It does take some getting used to.
Smoke grinned as the young boy held his cup out for a refill. Spotted Elk held out his hand to stop Running Deer, trying to impart some manners to the kid. But Smoke shook his head.
That's all right. We have plenty more.
Smoke refilled the boy's cup and watched him drink it slower this time, savoring the sweetness of the coffee.
We're looking for Gray Wolf.
Smoke pointed over his shoulder at the four horses tied nearby.
We have presents for your tribe, and come in peace to make a trade.
Spotted Elk finished his coffee and handed the cup back to Smoke, then walked over to run his hands down the flanks of the horses, stopping to pry open their mouths and glance at their teeth as he examined them.
These will make great presents indeed.
As Spotted Elk got on his pony, Smoke handed him the dally rope to the horses, letting him lead the animals into the village so he would get credit for the trade. In this way, Smoke knew they had at least one ally among the Nez Perce who would help break the ice in the upcoming bargain for the Palouse ponies they were after. Smoke and Cal and Pearly followed Spotted Elk into the main part of the Nez Perce camp. In addition to the numerous hide huts and deerskin teepees, there were several log structures and elaborate lean-tos, showing the semi-permanent nature of their camp. Smoke pointed out the wooden structures to Cal and Pearly.
Evidently, the Nez Perce return to this same location every winter. Some of those cabins look like they're several years old, at least.
I always thought Injuns roamed around, making camps wherever they happened to stop.
That used to be true. But lately, since they've become more peaceful and less warlike, and more used to the white man's presence, they seem to have become more settled in their ways. Just another part of the life up here that's passed on due to interference by white men, and will never be the same.
A brave stepped from one of the largest of the wooden cabins, holding his spread hands in welcome. Smoke was surprised at his young age.
That must be Gray Wolf. I would have thought he'd be older to be a chief.
The Injun appeared to be in his late 30s or early 40s, very young for a full chief of the Nez Perce, who, like most Injun tribes, equated age with wisdom in choosing their leaders.
Welcome.
Gray Wolf's face showed neither happiness nor dismay to see him.
Indians would make great poker players. They don't tend to show their emotions much.
Smoke walked up to the chief.
Hello. I am Man Who Walks on Mountain.
We have heard your song many times. One of our Kiowa brothers, Walking Bear, sent word of what you did for his people in the White Eyes camp called Denver. He said you are known as an honorable man and friend to all our peoples.
Smoke nodded, not saying anything, waiting to see what would happen next. He knew Injuns could be notional, welcoming one minute and dangerous the next.
Come inside. We will smoke and eat. As friends should.
The chief turned and led the way into his cabin. When they entered, Smoke and Cal and Pearly found the floor to be dirt, covered with elaborate hides of deer skin and bear skin. In the middle of the room, underneath a hole in the roof, was a small fire. Gray Wolf waved him to be seated next to the fire, and he joined him, sitting cross-legged on the ground. Spotted Elk and the younger brave who had been with him at Smoke's camp joined him around the fire. Gray Wolf pointed at the young brave.
This is my son, Running Deer. He is to be next chief of Nez Perce someday.
He is a fine-looking young brave. He will bring much honor to your house.
Gray Wolf picked up a wooden pipe and put it in his mouth, lighting it with a burning branch from the fire. Gray Wolf handed it across to Smoke. Smoke passed it over to Cal and Pearly. After everyone around the fire had tasted of the pipe, Smoke took a handful of cigars from his pocket and passed them out. The chief quickly put the pipe down and lighted one of the cigars, showing he didn't much care for the taste of his tobacco neither. After a few minutes, the chief signaled a woman kneeling behind him, and she ladled liquid from a pot on the edge of the fire into small bowls and gave each of the visitors one.
What do you suppose this is?
Smoke plucked a chunk of meat out of the stew and popped it in his mouth, chewing and smiling at the same time.
Elk stew. Eat it. Try to look like you enjoy it, or you'll insult our host.
Eating with their fingers, since Injuns didn't use spoons and forks, they soon finished the stew. Ooh. Curly smacking his lips as if it was the best thing he'd ever eaten.
Spotted Elk has shown me your gifts to the Nez Perce. What do you ask in trade?
I would like to take with me some of your spotted ponies. 2 males and 2 females.
Why do you wish our spotted ponies? Your horses seem adequate for your needs.
I have a ranch in Colorado, and I know the spotted ponies of the Nez Perce can run like the wind from sunup to sundown without tiring. I have need of such animals in my herd. They will add much to my stature among the white eyes of my tribe.
You have traveled far to get these ponies. You wish them very bad, no?
That is true. In addition to the horses I have already offered, I have brought white men's wampum, greenback dollars, or gold if you prefer.
Smoke opened his buckskin shirt and pulled out his money belt. He took out a handful of $100 bills along with a handful of gold double eagle pieces, and he spread them on the rug in front of him. Grey Wolf smiled and spread his hands.
Oh, your white man dollars are of no use to us here on the mountain.
In the spring, when you and your people travel to the south to graze your ponies and hunt the elk and deer to fill your cooking pots, these dollars can be traded for whatever you need in the white man's camps. Tools, knives, food or grain for your ponies, beads, mirrors, blankets for your squaws.
Smoke held up $100 bill.
Just one of these brought Walking Bear enough food to feed all his people for the entire winter.
Spotted Elk leaned over and whispered into Grey Wolf's ear. Smoke couldn't make out what he was saying.
Spotted Elk tells me the knives of the White Eyes are much superior to ours, and that your gold can buy many knives.
Spotted Elk speaks with much wisdom.
Smoke took the bowie knife from his belt and held out his hand to Spotted Elk, who after a moment passed over his handmade knife to Smoke. Smoke swung the bowie knife, and it cut through the blade of Spotted Elk's knife as if it were made of wood. As Grey Wolf's eyes widened, Smoke handed the bowie knife across to him.
For you, a blade as strong as a Nez Perce's chief is.
The chief sat a little straighter at Smoke's words, a slight smile tugging at the corner of his lips. Smoke got to his feet.
We have more on our pack horse.
Smoke walked outside, followed by the chief and Spotted Elk and Running Deer. He stepped to the pack horse and untied the ropes holding a large canvas bag to the back of the mount, letting it fall to the ground. When the pack hit the ground, it opened, spilling out piles of metal pots and pans, knives, woven woolen blankets in bright colors, and several packages of candies, coffee, tobacco, and flour. Smoke bent and took a package of peppermint sticks and handed them to Running Deer, who quickly put one in his mouth, his eyes wide with delight.
Let us go to our ponies to find some suitable for your fine gifts.
They walked over toward where the Palouse herd was confined in a large corral of bushes set in a large semicircle, leaving the tribe's squaws to paw through the pots and pans and blankets, chattering like small children at the treasure. One of the studs immediately caught Smoke's eye. He was taller than the others and heavily muscled for a Palouse, which tended to be slimmer than white man's horses. The chief saw where Smoke was looking, and he nodded.
A man who walks on mountain has a good eye for pony. That is one of my best. Stronger and faster than the other.
Spotted Elk quickly jumped over the bushes and walked into the herd of horses. grabbing several by the rope halters the Injuns used instead of the leather ones used by white men. Soon they had two magnificent studs, one gray with dark black spots on its rump, and another one with reddish-colored spots over a white coat. Both had the blue eyes with a circle around the iris, showing the true full-blooded Palouse genes. The mares were only slightly smaller, and both had good lines, with strong legs and sleek muscles, showing they had been very well cared for.
Are these what you wish?
These are just what I've been looking for.
Then may they carry you past your enemies in time of need, man who walks on mountain.
Smoke looked over his shoulder at Pearly and Cal.
Throw a rope over these horses, boys, before he changes his mind.
Pearly took the rope halters in his hand while Cal tied dally ropes to the animals.
Smoke, these are some of the finest Palouse I ever seen.
These boys make old Seven of Mike jealous when they're put out to breed alongside of him.
If they turn out to be half the horse old Seven was, they'll do just fine. Excuse me for a minute, boys. There's something I'm to ask Grey Wolf before we leave.
Smoke took Grey Wolf by the arm and led him off to a spot a few yards away. He began to talk to him in a low tone that Cal and Pearly couldn't quite make out. As they talked, the chief looked over at the two young cowboys occasionally, a smile on his face as he nodded his head. After talking earnestly with the chief for about 5 minutes, Smoke grinned and shook the brave's hand, and then returned to where Cal and Pearly were holding the Palouse horses. Soon, the trio had said their goodbyes to Grey Wolf and Spotted Elk, and they were on their way back down the mountain toward Buffalo. They made good time, since the weather had cleared and they were going with the north wind instead of against it.
Smoke, when we breathe these Palouse with those Morgans you got from John Chisholm, we gonna have the best remuda in the territory.
If we can manage to get the speed and intelligence from the Morgans mixed with the bottom and toughness of the Palouse into one animal, it'll be a tough horse to beat.
As they made their way down the mountain, Pearly looked over at Cal, a satisfied smile on his face.
Well, Cal, I guess Miss Sally won't have to skin us alive after all.
What do you mean?
When she sent us up here after you, Miss Sally as much as said if and we let anything happen to you, she'd never let us forget it.
And now that we've cleared up that little fracas down in Johnson County, and you got the Palouse you came after, shouldn't be too hard to get you home with your hide in one piece.
Who said we're heading home right away?
Well, I don't like the sound of that, Pearly.
Well, ain't we?
Not just yet, we aren't. There's some things I wanted to do before we head back to Colorado.
Oh, such as?
When I got the cavalry involved, I was promised those boys that killed my friend Nate and Nick were going to be tried for their crimes. Once I make sure that's going to happen, then the Johnson County War is over, and not before.
Please, God, let things go the way they're supposed to, just once.
Smoke, if someone ends up shooting a hole in you, Miss Sal will never bake us no bear sign, no pies again.
Well, boys, knowing how much you like Sally's cooking, I'll do my best not to let that happen.
Besides, that Colonel Van Horn looked like a right honorable man. I'm sure he was telling the truth when he told Smoke those boys were going to get tried for the killings.
Yeah. Well, it's not Van Horn I'm worried about. It's those lily-livered politicians in Cheyenne that control things that are liable to muck things up. I never met a politician, or a lawyer for that matter, that didn't know which hand held the money. Most of them don't give a damn about justice. Just where their next payoff is coming from.
Smoke, you said there were a couple of things you wanted to do. If one of them is making sure those regulators get what's coming to them, what's the other?
Smoke looked over at Cal and Pearly, a slight smile playing on his lips.
Well, it occurred to me when we were up there with the Nez Perce that the only thing you boys know about the mountain men are what you've heard sitting around a campfire.
So?
I think it's about time I broaden your education a mite. What do you say to staying up here, in the mountains, and doing a little hunting and camping for a couple of weeks?
Cal glanced back at their pack animal, and its bare back.
But Smoke, we ain't hardly got no supplies left at all.
That's the point, boys. You need to learn how to live up here like the mountain men did. Hunting and killing your food. Living off the land without relying on store-bought supplies for your life.
Does that mean eating bark and such?
Hell no, Pearly. The High Lonesome is God's own general store. He's put everything you need to live right here for the taking. All you got to do is learn how to take it before it takes you.
But Smoke, you said the Indians done marked this land as theirs. They'd be mighty pissed off if and we hunted it.
Well, that's right, Pearly. That's why I had that little palaver with Chief Grey Wolf before we left. I told him you boys were pilgrims who needed some lessons only the High Lonesome could teach. He agreed on how important that was for young men to learn. So he gave me his permission to camp up here for a while and teach you what I could about living on the mountain.
Gee Williker, Smoke. I think it'd be a great adventure.
I guess so. After all, that elk stew wasn't so bad.
Good. Then it's decided.
Smoke jerked his horse's head around and headed off in a wide sweep back up the mountain toward areas remote from the engine's camp.
Wait a minute. What about Miss Sally? Won't she be worried?
Nah. Before we left Buffalo, I wired Sheriff Monte Carson in Big Rock, telling him to let her know we were all right and we'd be home when we got there and not to worry. You boys had the situation well in hand.
When it came time to lead the trail and head up into untraveled territory through snowdrifts 2 and 3 feet deep, Smoke hung back.
I'm gonna let you boys take the lead and see if you remember what I told you about picking a place to make our base camp.
No problem. Come on, Pearly. Let's see if we can find a stream that ain't iced over with plenty of beaver on it.
Yeah, we need to find someplace sheltered from the wind and snow, near a cliff or overhang, or in some heavy timber so we won't freeze our cojones off when the next blizzard hits.
Smoke smiled to himself, thinking just how much he was going to enjoy imparting some of the knowledge Creature had given to him during his early days in the mountains. It was getting close to dusk before they found a suitable campsite. It was situated next to a sheer stone face of a mountain wall, facing south so the north wind would be blocked during snowstorms. A rushing stream was within 20 yards of the camp, and there was evidence of several beaver dams within easy reach, indicating an abundance of wildlife. The site was below the timber line, so there was plenty of woodfall for making fires, and the trees had many low-hanging limbs that would be useful for forming sides and roofs on the lean-to Smoke would show them how to build to keep the worst of the weather off of them. As they gathered wood for their first fire, Smoke stood in the small clearing with his hands on his hips, satisfied the boys would be apt pupils for what he had to teach them. He helped them pick out fist-sized stones to place in a circle around the fire, explaining how the rocks were called gravel and had been deposited by giant glaciers that had moved through the area millions of years before. He showed them how to build a pit for their waste away from the camp, and told them how it had to be covered over so it wouldn't bring predators like bears and mountain lions to their camp. That first night, before they had their lean-tos built, they were lucky and the skies were clear with little snowfall. They sat around the fire and made a meal of hot coffee, strong enough to float a horseshoe, and dried jerked beef, hard enough to break a tooth if they weren't careful. Sitting there with a roof of stars over their heads, warmed by the golden flames of a wood fire, Smoke told them stories of the mountain men he had known and camped with, men who were legends in the lore of the early frontier. Men with names like Preacher, Puma Buck, Huggy Charles, Dupree, Grizzly Jones, and others. Men who would live their entire lives forsaking the company of other men to be alone in the High Lonesome. Finally, Cal and Pearly fell asleep with visions of buckskin-clad men fighting bears, lions, and Injuns, forging lives of happy solitude in the highest reaches of frozen mountain ranges. When dawn came, cold and clear, Smoke began his lessons. He instructed the boys on which trees to cut to form the walls of their lean-to, how to strip the smaller branches, leaving the topmost ones for forming the roof, placing the poles at an angle against the side of the mountain cliff so as to shed the snow that was sure to come when the next winter storm hit. Once they had their shelter completed, he led them on a hunting expedition, both for food and for furs, to help ward off the freezing temperatures he expected in the coming days. Cal was the first to shoot, picking out a large doe deer after Smoke told him to ignore the buck standing nearby, since the doe's meat would be much more tender and less gamey to the taste. Once they had skinned the deer, hanging the skin away from the camp to cure, he had him hang the meat from a tree, suspended out of reach of hungry bears or mountain lions. Next, they went hunting for bear to get skins to line the walls of the lean-to and to sleep under for warmth. He showed them how to track the big animals, following spore of bear droppings as well as tracks in the fresh snow. They passed up several shots at females who had small cubs in tow, Smoke telling them not to kill the mothers as the cubs couldn't survive on their own. And so they kept walking through dense undergrowth. Suddenly, a giant grizzly reared up, spreading his arms. Pearly, standing firm and unafraid, raised his rifle and planted his feet. As the animal charged, Pearly stood his ground.
Damn! That was a fine shot, Pearly.
Pearly, who was white-faced and had trembling hands now that the danger was past, grinned.
Whew, that was close. Those bears can move faster than I thought.
They can outrun the fastest horse for short distances, especially through deep snow. That's something it'll pay you to remember if you ever jump one on horseback.
Smoke handed the skinning knife to Pearly.
Here, son. It's your kill, so you get to do the honors.
As Pearly approached the dead bear, he suddenly drew back, making a face.
Oh, God almighty, it stinks to high heaven.
Well, bears aren't partial to baths, Pearly. And neither are mountain men, except maybe once a year in the spring. A couple of weeks up here and you won't smell much different.
As the days on the mountain passed, Cal and Pearly soaked up the knowledge Smoke taught them like sponges. Before long, they were skinning and cutting wild game as if they were born to it. Smoke was amazed at how rapidly they assimilated the lessons of living in the high lonesome, thinking they would have made admirable mountain men if they'd been born 30 years sooner. The boys, for their part, mostly looked forward to the nights spent around the campfire, listening to the tales of mountain men Smoke told them each night. When their store-bought supplies ran out, Smoke taught them to make coffee from ground-up acorns and pinion nuts, how to pick grapevines to smoke instead of tobacco, and how to make a passable flour out of roots of certain trees. He taught them to hunt for and find wild onions and yams, which berries could be safely eaten and which would cause debilitating stomach cramps, and how to build traps for beavers and birds and squirrels, saving their precious ammunition, which was beginning to run low. On this diet, the baby fat the boys had accumulated melted off, and they became lean, and their muscles began to strengthen and grow wiry from the hard physical labor of surviving in the wilderness. Smoke taught them to make needles from birds' bones and rawhide string from deer hides so they could mend and take up their clothes that were hanging loosely on their now thin bodies. Soon, they were all wearing homemade buckskins, much like the mountain men they had seen. Cal was even sporting a wispy thin beard, since shaving with the frigid mountain stream water didn't much appeal to him. Toward the end of their sojourn, Smoke took to staying in camp, getting the Palouse horses used to having saddles on their backs instead of engine blankets, while Cal and Pearly ran their traps and hunted for food and fresh vegetables in the woods. Finally, Smoke decided they were ready to leave the mountains, the boys having learned enough about being mountain men to be able to survive on their own if need be. On their last night around the campfire, Smoke took out his knife and lightly touched Cal on the shoulder.
Let's see. I am giving you a mountain man name, Cal. I'm going to call you Deer Stalker Woods, for your ability to sneak up on a deer close enough to spit in its eye without him ever hearing you. Pearly, your mountain man name will be Hawkeye, because you've become one of the best trackers I've ever known. I think you could track a field mouse through a blizzard if you had to.
Do we have to leave?
Yeah. It's time we headed back down the mountain to see what became of the men who killed Nate Champion and Nick Ray. I have a feeling we have some unfinished business with those boys.
When Smoke and Cal and Pearly rode into Buffalo, they got some strange looks. They were still in their buckskins, Cal's and Pearly's only partially cured, and all three had heavy beards and long unkempt hair. They took their horses to the livery stable and instructed the man there to rub them down and feed them plenty of grain. Then they headed toward the hotel. As they approached the door to the hotel, Sheriff Red Angus was walking along the boardwalk toward him from the opposite direction. When he saw him, he stopped and stared at Smoke with his head cocked to one side.
Smoke Jensen? Is that you?
Yeah, Sheriff, it is. What can I do for you?
Jesus, you boys are a mite gamey.
3 weeks in the mountains will do that to you.
Well, I just wanted to warn you. Things aren't going so good here in Johnson County since the army came and took the regulators away.
Oh? What do you mean?
Angus looked nervously around to see if anyone was watching, then put his hand on Smoke's arm and ushered him off the street and into the hotel lobby.
It's too complicated to go into right now. Why don't you boys get cleaned up and then meet me over at my office?
Sheriff, I don't know what's got you so riled up, but we intend to take a hot bath, then go to the dining room for a good meal. We've been eating out of a pan for 3 weeks, and we all want a good meal. If you want to talk to us, you can meet us here in, about an hour.
All right. Only watch your backs till I get to talk to you. You ain't exactly the most popular gent in town right now.
Smoke pursed his lips as he watched Angus walk away, wondering what the hell was going on. After a moment, Pearlie touched his arm.
Smoke, I think we better go get those baths before the manager has to open all the windows in this place.
They walked up to the front desk.
I need 3 rooms and 3 baths with plenty of hot water.
The desk man peered down his nose at the 3 men standing before him, the expression on his face showing he did not like the way they smelled and looked.
We don't rent to, men such as you. I suggest you take your business down the street to a less expensive establishment.
Smoke opened his shirt and unbuttoned his money belt, letting the clerk see the wads of greenbacks in it. He pulled a $100 bill out of the stack and handed it to the man.
Partner, how about getting those baths ready? And you just let me know when you've gone through this one, and we'll give you another one just like it, all right?
Yes, sir.
A little bit later, the 3 grizzled mountain men each found themselves in a nice hot bath. Pearlie took a long-handled brush, rubbed soap on it, and began to scrub his back, an expression of near ecstasy on his face.
Oh! Whew! You know, Smoke, I ain't ever been one to be specially fond of baths, but I gotta tell you, after 3 weeks in the high lonesome freezing my butt off, this ranks right up there with Miss Sally's bear sign.
Oh, I don't know about that, Pearlie, but this do feel right nice.
I love the mountains, boys, but there is something to be said for civilization, too.
The attendant came back into the room after taking their stinking buckskins out to burn, and he stared at the men with wide eyes.
Are you mountain men?
Smoke glanced at Cal and Pearlie.
We sure are, young fella. Those two over there are two of the roughest, toughest mountain men I've ever had the pleasure to make camp with.
Cal and Pearlie beamed at the compliment, sitting a little straighter in their baths.
Well, what's it like living up in the mountains?
Well, other than the bears and mountain lions and wolves trying to make you their dinner, and the Injuns want to take your scalp and hang it on their lodge pole, it ain't so bad.
And if the temperature don't get much under 30 below and the snow stays less than 5 feet deep, it ain't bad at all.
Smoke grinned, thinking about how much both Cal and Pearlie had been changed by their experience in the high lonesome. Cal was no longer just a cowboy in his teens. He seemed to have matured from having to face death on a daily basis, with only his skill and brains to keep him alive. There's nothing like knowing you're only one mistake away from being killed to make a man grow up fast and give him confidence. Smoke climbed out of the tub and dried off, the attendant's eyes widening again at the sight of his massive body covered with knife and bullet scars from all the scrapes he'd been in. Smoke stepped in front of a mirror hung on a pole and began to shave his beard off.
You planning on shaving, Cal?
Well, I ain't decided yet. You think this growth makes me look older?
Uglier, if in that's possible. Not particularly older.
You better shave it off, Cal. If I take you home looking like that, Sally's liable to shoot you, thinking you're a bandito or a rustler come to steal our stock.
Pearlie looked at Cal's hair hanging down over his eyes.
Little time in a barber's chair wouldn't do any of us any harm, neither.
Finally, when they had soaked and scrubbed until their skin was red and shining, and after they'd shaved their beards, Cal electing to leave his wispy mustache in place, they climbed into fresh clothes and headed down the stairs toward the dining room.
Whew, I can already taste that beefsteak.
Smoke, I ain't saying you ain't a right good cook, but it'll sure be nice to eat some meat you don't have to cut with an axe before you put it in your mouth.
Just as the waiter placed their food in front of them, along with steaming cups of real coffee, Sheriff Angus walked up and took a seat at their table.
Would you like something to eat, Sheriff?
No. To tell you the truth, I ain't had much of an appetite lately, Jensen.
Why don't you tell us what's going on around here that has you all riled up, Sheriff?
Angus looked around over his shoulder to make sure no one else was listening, then leaned forward.
Jensen, since that fracas with the regulators, this county's gone to hell. Before they came, it was a nice place to live. Oh, sure, we had a little rustling and a little stealing, but it was on a minor scale, and was mainly directed against the large ranchers that could afford to lose a few head of stock.
Things have changed.
You're damn right they have, and not for the better. I've lost all control of the county. The men around here have gone from being minor outlaws to full-fledged desperados. They're going around shooting and killing everybody they think may have helped out the regulators.
Well, you got to expect that.
Yeah, but they're not stopping there. There's a lot of men taking advantage of this, and they consider anybody who has something they want to be fair game. Hell, just the other day, the foreman of the whole ranch, George Wellman, was gunned down in cold blood all for about 10 head of beef.
You know who did it?
Sure, but there ain't no way I could get a jury in this county to convict him. I tell you, Jensen, it's become every man for himself around here.
Sounds like you got yourself a problem, Sheriff.
That's for sure. And to make matters worse, Tom Horn and the other so-called stock detectives are still out there shooting up anybody they think is rustling the big ranch's cattle.
I thought all that would stop when the regulators and the men who led them were put on trial for killing Nate Champion and Nick Ray.
Well, I guess you ain't heard about that little fiasco either.
No. Tell me.
Soon after Walcott and Canton and Smith and their men were taken to Fort McKinney, a sympathetic judge said they couldn't get a fair trial in Johnson County, so they were taken by train to Cheyenne.
As if the trial there would be fair.
Exactly. Hell, they were transported in a private Pullman car stocked with champagne and all the whiskey they could drink.
Sounds like the fix was in.
You got that right. They were set up in a bowling alley in Fort Russell and given anything they wanted, including visits from their wives and other female friends.
What about the trial?
The only charges brought were for the killings of Nate Champion and Nick Ray. And since the only witnesses were you and that mountain man, and nobody made any effort to get you to testify, the prisoners were turned loose without any bond. Well, hell, by then we knew we'd never win any case against them in Cheyenne, so the charges were all dropped.
What about the gunmen from Texas?
They've all gone on their way. Some back to Texas, others to God only knows where.
So no one is going to be made to pay for killing Nate and Nick, huh?
Not by the law, they ain't.
Well then, maybe it's time someone other than the law took a hand in the matter.
I got to warn you, Jensen, to watch your back. There ain't any men on either side you can count as your friends.
That's the way I like it, Sheriff. Then I don't have to worry about who gets in my way. You know, Sheriff, a man's got to have a creed to live by. A set of standards that he just won't violate. Me, I'm an Old Testament kind of person. And I still believe in the old adage, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth.
Jensen, I hope to hell you ain't planning on trying to get vengeance on your own for Champion and Ray. You won't stand a chance in Cheyenne, because them boys got the law in the palm of their hands.
That may be so, Sheriff, but it doesn't matter a whole lot. By the time they know I'm coming after them, it'll be too late to do anything about it. Did you ever see a rattlesnake warn the rabbit before it strikes?
The sheriff shook his head, not really sure he understood what this very dangerous man sitting across from him meant, but he was sure thankful he didn't have him on his back trail.
Now, Sheriff Angus, I want you to tell me all you know about the men behind the regulators, the men who are really responsible for what happened here in Johnson County.
Smoke and Cal and Pearlie got off the train in Cheyenne and made arrangements for their horses to be boarded in the livery stable for a few days until they were ready to leave again. They found a hotel in the seedier part of town. A place so low on the economic scale that Smoke was sure none of the wealthy men he was going after would find out where they were. After eating a meal that even Pearly wasn't too happy about, they met in Smoke's room to plan their attack.
I wish you boys would reconsider and go back to Colorado and let me do this on my own.
Not a chance, Smoke. Miss Sally would cut us off at the knees if she found out we didn't back your play in this.
Besides, men don't take off and turn tail when their partner's up against the kind of odds you're facing here. From what Sheriff Angus said, there are over 100 members of the Cheyenne Club.
Well, we're not going after all 100 members. Just those directly responsible for the killings in Johnson County. There's a book Sally got me to read a while back. It's called The Art of War, by some Japanese man whose name I don't recall right now. Anyway, one of the things he emphasizes if you're going to war with someone is to learn all you can about your enemy before you try to take him on.
Is that the book you told us about, with those men dressed all in black, the ones called ninjas?
Yes, it is. Now, what we have to do is hang around the Cheyenne Club for a day or two and find out all we can about how it operates, how to get in and out in a hurry, and then ask around and see if we can find some time when the men we're after are all going to be there together.
Why don't we just take them out one at a time?
Because after the first one or two, they'd know we were coming and would be ready for us. Nah, we're only going to get one chance at this, and we better do it right the first time. Remember, these are powerful men who have the entire law enforcement system on their side.
After talking some more about their plans, the three walked over to the more exclusive part of town, where the Cheyenne Club was located. They spent 2 days watching men come and go from the place, making sure no one noticed them hanging around. By spreading some money around in the local saloons and stores, Smoke was able to learn all about the men he was interested in. Major Walcott, Frank Canton, and the two men who'd planned the whole expedition, Hubert Teschmacher and Frederick DeBillier. And Smoke and his band were in luck. They learned that Teschmacher, DeBillier, Walcott, and several others played poker in a weekly high-stakes game, and that on those nights, the club was otherwise almost deserted since it was the middle of the week. Cal managed to hire on with a local whiskey merchant, and he did some deliveries to the club, managing to learn about the interior layout and how best to get in and then out again without getting trapped inside. He also found out there were only two guards, one in front, one in the back. The patrons evidently feeling they were secure in this high-class part of town. When the night of the poker game arrived, Smoke took all of their baggage and their horses and loaded them on the train that was overnighting in the station. It was supposed to leave for Denver the next day at 8 o'clock in the morning, and he planned that they would be on it and headed out of town before the law could be mobilized to come after them. Smoke and the boys ate a large dinner, and they took their time about it. They wanted the poker game to be well underway, and the men in it heavy into their whiskey and wine before they struck. And the later they made it, the less time the sheriff and Cheyenne would have to track them down. It was 2 a.m. when Smoke walked up to the guard at the rear entrance to the Cheyenne Club.
This is a private club. Get away from here!
Smoke grabbed the man's hand, and with a sudden downward motion, he twisted and turned it back, breaking the guard's wrist and driving him to his knees. Smoke threw a short right cross that snapped the man's face to the side. Cal and Pearly appeared out of the shadows, their arms full of weapons. Cal handed Smoke his greener 10-gauge short-barreled express gun, while keeping a sawed-off 12-gauge of his own. Pearly had two pistols stuck in his belt, along with one in his holster. Smoke opened the door and let Cal lead him into the building and up the stairs to the third floor meeting room where the poker game was being played. They stepped into the room but stayed back in the shadows, wanting to get a feel for the place before they made their move. Teschmacher and DeBillier were sitting next to each other with Walcott on their left and four other men arranged around the table. Smoke recognized some of them from Angus's descriptions, and he knew that all of these men bore responsibility for the Johnson County massacre of his friends. Fred Hess, the Englishman who managed a large ranching system for distant owners, was directly across from Walcott, And next to him was William Irving, director of the Cheyenne and Northern Railroad. The other two men were unknown to Smoke. As Smoke and his friends watched, Walcott dealt the cards. They were playing five-card stud. After looking at his hole card for a few seconds, DeBillier made the first bet.
Ace bets 100.
That little bitsy old ace isn't going to win this hand, Freddy.
Teschmacher shoved a pile of chips out into the pot.
I'll call the 100 and raise another 200.
Walcott frowned.
Oh, damn. You boys must be drunk to be betting like that after only two cards. I fold.
Smoke walked out into the light, his shotgun cradled in his arms.
Howdy, gents. Mind if I ante up in this game?
The men's face blanched and their eyes widened at the sight of the three cowboys loaded for bear walking into the room.
How did you get in here? This is a private club.
Why, we just walked right in. We heard there was big game up here and thought we'd join in the fun.
Bullshit! You're here to rob us!
Well, you're out of luck, gentlemen. We play with chips and IOUs here. There isn't any cash.
Smoke stepped over to the table and in a lightning-fast movement slapped DeBillier across the face with the back of his hand.
No, I think you're out of luck, DeBillier.
Who are you men, and why are you here?
Hess's hand slowly moved inside his coat. Cal leaned over and put the barrel of his shotgun against Hess's forehead.
That better be a cigar you're reaching for, mister. Otherwise, even your best friend won't recognize you after I let these hammers down.
Hess brought out a Derringer two-shot pistol, holding it delicately with two fingers by the barrel.
Here, take it. I wasn't going to use it anyway.
We're friends of Nate Champion and Nick Ray, the men you paid to have slaughtered in Johnson County.
But we've already been tried for that, and we're acquitted.
In a court, your cattle money bought, and by a judge in your pay. That don't count a whole lot with us. You see, I was there that night, and I know what you did.
You! You're the man who called himself Kirby that was in the cabin with Champion. But I don't understand. Aren't you also the one who went to Fort McKinney and got the troops that saved our lives up in Buffalo?
Just one of the mistakes I made in my life. Wasn't the first, and it won't be the last.
Walcott jumped to his feet, and Smoke noticed he was wearing a sidearm, a big Colt Army 44 pistol.
I won't stand for this intimidation. You men are trespassing here, and I demand that you leave at once.
Smoke slowly turned and placed the shotgun on the floor, butt first, leaning it against a post. He squared his shoulders and faced Walcott, his hands hanging at his side next to his pistols.
I see you're armed, Major. Why don't you make us leave? All it takes is for you to go for that hog leg on your hip.
And have your hooligan friends shoot me down?
They won't interfere. You have my word on it. You and your friends here called the dance up in Johnson County. Now it's time someone paid the band. Fill your hand, you dirtbag.
I've seen you draw, Kirby. You're a professional gunfighter. I wouldn't stand a chance.
I figure about the same chance Nate and Nick had when they were ambushed in their own home without warning. Now, are you going to show some courage and draw, or not?
I don't think so. I'll not give you the satisfaction of killing me.
You're a coward, aren't you? Pretty tough when you're leading 100 men against 2 lone men. But when it comes down to standing up for your honor, when the odds are 1-1, you don't have the sand.
Walcott hung his head, looking at the floor. With a horrified expression on his face, Hubert Teschmacher leapt to his feet.
God help! Help! Come quick!
Cal quickly stepped over and smashed the butt of his shotgun against Teschmacher's face. Oh! The door at the end of the room burst open and three men with drawn pistols charged into the room. Smoke whirled and drew, his hand moving so fast it was almost a blur. Cal leveled a shotgun at the men. Kirby filled his hand with iron, drawing and cocking only a second behind Smoke. As the smoke slowly cleared and the men at the poker table could see what had happened, Frederick DeBillier leaned over to the side and vomited on his $200 boots. William Irving, no stranger to violence himself, screwed up his face and looked away from the carnage, certain that in a few minutes the same damn thing was going to happen to him. Hubert Teschmacher stared at the bloody mess of his guards with wide eyes, his ruined mouth and lips so swollen he couldn't speak, bloodstains covering the front of his expensive suit. Tears ran down Fred Hess's cheeks as he contemplated his own death, his eyes fixed on the table in front of him, as if by not looking at his attackers, he could forestall their wrath. Walcott remained unconscious on the floor and was spared the spectacle of the guard's death.
Would you look at these men, boys? The most powerful men in the territory, and not one of them is willing to stand up and fight for their lives. I guess they have to have others do that for them, since they haven't got the guts to do it for themselves.
Cal and Pearlie nodded, glaring at the men as though they were something that would crawl out from under a rock. Smoke picked up his shotgun and eared back the hammers.
Well, it's clear these men aren't worth killing, but maybe we can leave them a message anyway.
Smoke turned and aimed his greener at the long mirror behind the 50-foot mahogany bar that had been imported from France. Cal calmly reloaded his shotgun, snapped the barrel into place, and aimed at the billiard table. Pearlie filled both hands with pistols and aimed at the portraits hanging on the walls.
Not the Monet!
Mon who?
William Irving, unable to stand it any longer and certain he was going to be killed anyway, jumped to his feet and clawed at his pistol. Smoke dropped his right hand. Irving grabbed his arm and he fell to the ground, trying to stop the spurting blood. Smoke looked at Pearlie and nodded, and the young man quickly stepped to Irving's side and took his bandana off. He wrapped it around the upper arm and tied it so that it cut the bleeding off.
There you go, mister. That'll save your hide, but you'll never use that arm to draw a piece again.
Smoke glanced around at the shattered and ruined Cheyenne Club, and then back at the men at the table.
Gents, I hope this teaches you a lesson. If it doesn't, or if I ever see any of you or men sent by you again, then I'll make you this promise. I will personally hunt each and every one of you down and shoot you like a dog, without warning and without mercy. You got my word on it. And you can give a message from me to Tom Horn. You tell him, if he ever comes down to Colorado, he better ride with his guns loose, because if I see him, I'll kill him on sight.
Smoke spun on his heels and walked out the door, followed by Cal and Pearlie. After their attackers were out of the building, De Billier straightened up and adjusted his vomit-stained clothes.
Those thugs will be sorry they did this. As soon as it's daylight, I'll have the sheriff and a posse on their trail.
Teschmacher, his eyes wide with fright, shook his head violently from side to side, though his mouth was so swollen he couldn't speak. Hess looked up through reddened and tear-stained eyes.
Are you crazy, Freddy? Did you see the look in that madman's eyes when he said he'd kill us if we sent anyone after him? I don't want any part of that. I vote we cut our losses and forget this ever happened.
Teschmacher and Irving, from his place on the floor, both nodded their agreement.
Now, get me a doctor. Before I bleed to death.
It was almost a week later that the train carrying Smoke and Cal and Pearlie and the Palouse horses pulled into Big Rock, Colorado, just after dawn. It was almost noon by the time they made their way on horseback to the Sugarloaf Ranch.
You know, fellas, I can almost smell those bear sign of Miss Sally's already.
Count on you, Pearlie, that the first thing you think of when you're getting home is food.
What else is more important?
Seeing the woman you love and miss like hell, for one thing.
When they were almost there, Sally appeared in the yard of the log cabin she and Smoke shared, her head cocked to the side as if she had somehow sensed the presence of her man. Smoke broke into a gallop and reined up just in front of her, jumping off his horse and sweeping her up in his arms. Sally finally broke the embrace and stepped back, her hands on her hips.
I need to have a few words with you, Mr. Jensen. Something about a promise to wire me when you got to Buffalo?
Now, wait a minute, Sally. There's a good explanation, and I'll tell you later. Right now, I want to get these Palouse into the pasture.
Sally turned, noticing the horses for the first time. She walked over and ran her hands down the flanks of one of the mares.
Oh, Smoke, they're beautiful. They're going to make a great addition to our remuda.
Let's put them in with Seven and see how the old man likes the company.
Pearlie opened the gate to the nearby pasture, where Seven, the palouse that Preacher had given to Smoke, resided. He was standing in a far corner, eating sweet green winter grass on the high mountain plateau. The two young studs and the two mares shook their heads and took off at a run when they were freed from their halters. Smoke, Cal, Pearlie, and Sally leaned on the wooden fence, watching to see how the old stud would take to the new additions to his pasture. As the newer animals ran into the open meadow, Seven perked up his ears and stood erect, sniffing the air. After a moment, he raced toward the two young stallions. The larger and more dominant of the two reared back on his hind legs and then galloped toward Seven, intending to meet his challenge. The two large palouse ran almost into each other, and they danced around for a minute. Then, in a lightning movement, Seven closed the distance between him and bent his head, biting at the jowls under the neck of the younger stud. They bumped and jostled each other briefly. Then Seven spun around and gave the youngster a heavy kick in his flanks with his hind legs, almost knocking the horse off his feet. He stumbled back, and then he turned tail and ran as Seven followed, nipping at his backside. After Seven had shown the newcomer who was boss, he trotted over toward the two mares, who were prancing around, their tails in the air, in obvious invitation.
Look at those hussies. They're too stupid to play hard to get when a male comes around.
Looks like the old stud still has the stuff in him to get them excited.
I'm kind of partial to old studs myself.
I guess right now might not be a particularly good time to ask Miss Sally to bake us some bear sign, would it?
Smoke Jensen, the Mountain Man, 23. Creed of the Mountain Man is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 1999, William W. Johnstone. Production copyright 2011, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Published by arrangement with Kensington Publishing Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Mort Shelby, James Lewis, Tim Getman, Drew Copas, Elizabeth Jernigan, Michael John Casey, Thomas Keegan, Tim Carlin, Richard Rowe, Nanette Savard, David Coyne, Thomas Penny, Christopher Sheeran, Terrence Aselford, Andy Clements, James Konacek, Joe Brack, Stephen Carpenter, Ken Jackson, Johann Detweiler, and Michael Glenn. Additional Boot Hill Boys by the Dead Giveaways. Directed by Johann Detweiler. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing, graphic audio sound design, and Smoke Jensen theme music by Johann Detweiler. Additional music by Johann Detweiler and Brian Patton. Book adapted for Graphic Audio by Johann Detweiler. If you enjoyed Creed of the Mountain Man, read the Pinnacle Edition. Visit www.kensingtonbooks.com. And be sure to look for William W. Johnstone's The First Mountain Man, The Last Mountain Man, Blood Bond, The Last Gunfighter, Eagles and Sidewinder series, as well as Elmer Kelton's Texas Rangers series. All available in graphic audio at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloads and podcasts. Now, keep listening for exciting previews of other titles in graphic audio. We appreciate it.
Tell me, Kip. If you've done bad things your whole life, but you die doing something good, do you think that makes up for all the bad?
No.
Me neither.
But it's better than nothing. Orcholum is merciful.
Wonder if you'll say that after they're done with your village.
Gavin Guile is the Prism, the most powerful man in the world. He is High Priest and Emperor, a man whose power, wit, and charm are all that preserves a tenuous peace. A peace that is slowly rotting from the inside out.
This is all that's left of what was once a great civilization. Statues of great men, broken by the pygmies who followed. Let me tell you something you already know. Something that all of you have believed, but no one dared to say. The wrong Guile won the Prism's war. They killed him because they were worried he would change everything. They feared him because Dazen Guile wanted to free us. Dazen knew that light cannot be chained.
As darkness slowly encroaches upon the land, Gavin receives a mysterious letter.
Undying Gavin, it's time you meet your son, Kip, Lena.
As Gavin races to find his son, he learns of a new and dangerous threat to his empire. A man who calls himself King.
Your time is finished. Yours and the Chromarians. You're done! Light cannot be chained. Know this, Prism. We will take back what you've stolen. The horrors of your reign are almost at an end. And when it ends, I will be there. This I swear!
With the death of his empire looming, Gavin will be forced to wage a war on multiple fronts. But little does he know, his assassin may be looking right before his very eyes.
You're a stupid, stupid boy, Kip. But maybe a dull sword can go where a sharp one wouldn't be allowed. Don't you forget this. Don't listen to him, you hear me? He's a liar. You will not fail me in this, Kip. You learn, and then you kill him.
Yes, Mother?
Kip, if you ever loved me, avenge me. Swear it by your worthless soul, Kip.
I swear to avenge you, Mother, by my very soul.
Don't miss the beginning of the end in Brent Week's critically acclaimed new series, The Lightbringer Trilogy. Book 1, The Black Prism, Parts 1 through 3. Available now in graphic audio.
Oh, the sound of death came to Frank Morton's ears through the forest.
Mister? You do this?
You really think one man could do this? I heard the shots and screams and rode up to see what was going on. I imagine the same thing brought you fellas here. Did you know these men?
Yeah, we knew them. We were all part of the same crew.
Then I'm sorry you lost your friends. You have any idea what might have happened?
The Terror.
Yeah, the Terror of the Redwoods.
What's that, some kind of animal?
It's not an animal, mister. It's a monster.
It's all right. That thing that killed your friends and hurt you is gone. You're safe now.
No, nobody's safe. Nobody's safe in the woods. The Terror's out there.
Did you see it?
It came out from behind a tree, knocked Billy off his horse. I never saw anything move so fast.
You wanted to see me, Mr. Bosworth?
Come inside.
Have you ever heard of a man named Frank Morgan?
Morgan? You mean the Drifter? Yeah, sure, I heard of him. Just about everybody west of the Mississippi has.
I thought you might know who he was, since you're in the same line of work. Are you actually acquainted with him?
We've crossed trails a time or two over the years.
Is he the sort of man who could be paid off?
Paid off? To do what?
To go away and mind his own business.
Frank Morgan? Paid to give up a job he's agreed to do? Not hardly.
You sure of that?
I'd stake my life on it.
Very well, then. I have a new job for you and your men, Grimshaw.
Thought you said you wouldn't be needing us for a while.
Well, that was before other matters came up. You'll have to leave this afternoon.
Where are we going? What's the job?
You're going to follow Frank Morgan into the woods and kill him.
Oh, hell.
Listen to me. I'm not going to hurt you. I'm a friend.
Oh.
He went that way!
Let it go! Find Morgan! We still got to kill him! Okay, you men spread out a couple hundred yards apart. Keep your eyes open.
Damn you, Frank. Why couldn't you have just kept riding? Why'd you have to get mixed up in all this?
The Last Gunfighter, number 20. Sudden Fury. Available now in Graphic Audio.
If you can't find that Graphic Audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different Graphic Audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.